Now, first, we will hear about the biodiversity and climate offset of this conference, and Linda Mustajärvi is presenting to you. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you. So, good day for everyone. I'm Linda, and I'm presenting the offset case of this Congress. I think about offset as some kind of scale, where on the other side we have the gains, and on the other, the losses. The aim of the Congress offset project was find out what are the losses of the Congress and whether those losses could be offset by restoring boreal peatland. This is the content of my presentation. So at first, I start with the losses, then we go through the gains, and then and in the end, I try to make some kind of conclusion for this all. The losses of this case are some kind of harmful ecological impacts. And we made a list of every kind of potential impact that this Congress could cause. But when we were rethinking this, it seems that most of these are somehow partial, like the road network here in Finland. It definitely causes some kind of habitat fragmentation and degradation, but it hasn't been built because of this Congress. It would be here also without our Congress, but still it might be so that our Congress is using that and though causing some kind of partial habitat loss. Also, there are some other additional losses, but basically the loss that we were estimating was the climate impacts of the travel, because those partial habitat losses is very, very difficult to estimate. So let's start with the climate impacts. In registration form, we asked what kind of vehicles you will use and what are the distances. I multiplied those distances by average carbon dioxide equivalent emissions per person kilometer. And this is the big news. What are the total emissions of our Congress? We cause 345 tons of carbon dioxide because of this Congress. You might think that this is just a number, but let me rephrase it. This is the same amount. We would need 19 persons from Finland and their yearly emissions to have the same amount that we are causing here. We would need 12 persons from USA to cause the same amount. And we would need 313 persons from Uganda and their yearly emission to cause same sort of emissions that we are causing. And our emissions happens in just 2 weeks, that others are from year. Let's talk about better things now, the gains. Or are there any gains? We decided that we used boreal peatland restoration as a gain, and why is that? Over half of our original peatland area here in Finland has been ditched for forestry use. And it of course have its effects on our peatland ecosystems and species. In peatland restoration, the ditches are filled which allows the water table to arise and peatland ecosystem recover. Our restoration site locates near Salamajärvi National Park. And as you can see in the maps, area is called Nälkäneva, and in late 60s, there were no ditches at all, but until the 90s, the area were ditched almost all over. In last autumn, Nälkäneva looked like this because there was restoration going on, but we visit there also in this spring. And of course, it might be too early to say, but it seems that water table has already arisen. We estimate the climate impacts of the restoration, and it seems that the total carbon dioxide emissions are decreasing at some point, but the methane emissions are growing. Because methane has a higher radiation force than carbon dioxide, we have to wait our offset until the year, that's right, 3479, if we use offset ratio 1:1. If we would know the impact of restoration for the habitat, different habitat types better, we could have achieved the offset in 150 years, but unfortunately it's a bit too late now. Okay, so the climate gain were not optimal. But what happens to habitats? In the picture you can see a different site and their different habitat conditions. One means that it's almost natural state, and zero means that the area is totally degraded. There's also different states, and blue means current state. Red one is a state after protection, and the green is state after restoration. And our gain is improvement between state after protection and state after restoration, because this area was protected before our restoration, and that protection might improve area a bit. And if we would count also that improvement, it would be a cheating, because the protection didn't happen because of our offset case. So improvements are the improvement of the gain is the yellow narrow. The main point is that it seems that the restoration will improve the areas near to natural state because of the offset, and I think this is a quite good thing for us. Also, there are some practical things that did take place because of our offset project. And as you might remember, I saw these maps before. Last autumn, the area were ditched all over, and the purple areas are the ones that we decided to restore. In year 2018, this spring, the maps look like this. So something has happened. If we want to make a conclusion of this all, the one main point might be that traveling to large international congress causes enormous emissions. I have to say that I was quite surprised when I see these numbers and was comparing those. Also, it seems that biodiversity gains might be easier to achieve than climate gains. And it might be so that we have devilish challenges between with fossil fuel and their offsets. It's really hard to have climate gains in anywhere. But overall, I think it is better than we do something than do no offsetting at all. If you want to follow this project, you can use this Instagram account and send me also messages there. But in the end, I would like to say thank you for you who joined the project and give a big hand.
Okay, thank you, Linda. And we actually have 2 minutes for the questions, if there is any questions. Over here, we have a question.
So, Santtu Kareksala from Parks and Wildlife Finland. So, should we understand correctly that the promised carbon compensation didn't not necessarily go exactly as planned? So, did you compensate, or do we just look a little bit greener now? And can we be refunded if this doesn't work?
I hope that no one was promising this, that this offset will work. But as you can see, at least we changed the map of the area, so something has happened. The thing that is it enough, this offset was totally known at loss, but involuntary based offset, I think it is really a good thing to do even something, even though it would be known at loss.
Thanks, Linda, for the great presentation. I'm Haney Grial from University of Melbourne. Did you look at how much we would have needed to pay in order to offset the impacts? And could we maybe use this as an indication for future SCB conferences to set our offset prices? Thanks.
Thank you for the question. I've tried to look at it, but it seems that it doesn't help if we are having a larger area of peatland which would be restored, because it will take such a long time still. But I don't know, if the big thing actually is that if we could do it some better way, is there anything better target that we should put our effort on? But I really hope that this offset practices is going and we can try them and learn from them.
Hello, thanks for doing this accounting. I found it really cool and wish that more conferences did this. My question is whether when you add up to that 300 some tons of emissions, is that the total emissions by the conference and its participants, or is that the additional emissions relative to what we would have done staying at home and also eating food, also driving, also using air conditioning and so forth?
Yeah, that emission is only about the Congress travel, so I haven't taken into account your normal activity and like summarizing that, but it could be a good idea to also think about in that. Thank you.
Okay, the next person we put in a bit difficult position. So Heikki Susiluoma is calling to tell us about the carbon stock market. Please.
Good day, everybody. Quite shocking figures we heard, but I'm sure we are going to change them in future. Carbon stock market, in Finnish hiilipörssi, is an innovation of the Finnish Association of Nature Conservation. It's a marketplace where anyone can pay for the restoration of drained peatland and at the same time compensate for his or her carbon footprint. Especially, for instance, restoring 1 hectare costs 800 euros and it compensates about 1/5 of the footprint of an average Finnish person. About the money, 15% is spent on the local nature activity and art. And the restoration also increases the biodiversity and improves the water quality of the lakes and rivers. And the hiilipörssi started 2-3 weeks ago and it's funded by Kone Foundation. The main function is to enable personal compensation. We help people to ease their anxiety of global warming, climate change. Hiilipörssi helps them to invest to the future and sink their extra money deep into the peatland to create more peat. Our slogan is honest speculation for the nature of bogs or peatlands. Hiilipörssi is a marketplace, but at the same time it is a research project. We are going to collect the most recent knowledge and experience about carbon emission all around the world, but especially in the peatlands in Finland. This helps us to tell people the facts behind our compensation works and the products in Hiilipörssi. I am myself interested in the reactions of people and organizations or societies about the personal compensation. I'm a social scientist specialized in participatory action research. We work in Hiilipörssi until June 2090 by the help of the Kone Foundation, but then we have to organize our work so that it supports itself. It's a marketplace. Our aim, or big dream, wet one, is that in 2030 we have restored 1 million hectares of drained peatland in Finland. It means about 800 million euros to be collected, invested. Carbon stock market got a quite good start 3 weeks ago. First day after publishing, we have got 10,000 euros, and just now, today, we have 36 investors and about 15,000 euros. First peatland to be restored is located in Lestijärvi, a small commune in central Finland. The peatland is owned by Finnish state and governed by Metsähallitus, Forest and Park Service in English. Metsähallitus has a lot of parks, peatlands which are drained and not forested enough. Local people in Lestijärvi are quite excited about the hiilipörssi. They hope that restoring peatlands helps to clean the important lake Lestijärvi. Since the 60s and 70s, in Finland, a colossal amount of peatlands have been drained in Finland, nearly 6 million hectares. The target was then to produce cheap raw material for the pulp industry. We can also call it some kind of patriotic project in Finland, in Finnish society after the World War II. Nearly 2 million of the drained peatlands do not produce economically enough wood, so there is a lot of work for us. We also hope that Hiilipörssi helps to stop the retraining. I don't know if this is quite right word. Retraining operations in the Finnish peatlands. Retraining has very bad effects on the water ecosystems. The calculation behind the carbon leaking. These figures are from our member Risto Sulkava. And you see the products later, and we have calculated together first the amount of carbon which flows out from drained peatland and after restoration is stopped. And secondly, the amount of carbon which is growing after the restoration every year, not the first 2 years or three, but in the long period. So we got an average 1,760 kilos per hectare per year. And the carbon emission figures are averages of the peatlands in Finland. So we likely get in Hiilipörssi more peatlands below these figures, so not so flourishing peatlands. That's why we put those carbon figures lower in our products. We call this some kind of safety factor. And here are our products. You can buy the restoration of the peatlands. The smallest is 50 euros, and it means about six acres restoration, 55 kilos carbon stored. And 1 hectare is 880 kilos. And the biggest product is 4,000 euros, and it's about average Finn can compensate his or her carbon leakage for whole his life. But we don't give to her or him permission to continue his or her lifestyle. We encourage people to change their habits at the same time. The Hiilipörssi is not the only solution. What's it? And what we are going to do? 65% we spent on the concrete restoration, about 20% about the governing and the climate work, and 15% about the local work, environmental work and art. In Lestijärvi, for instance, the local nature club is fixing the hiking road with the other local societies in Lestijärvi. And the ownership of the peatland, it remains the same. It doesn't change after restoration. And the restoration project costs nothing for the owner, but he doesn't get any money profits. But in the future, the peatland produce berries, cloudberries, water cleaning, ecological benefits, and other recreational benefits or ecological services. After the opening of Hiilipörssi, we have got many contacts from peatland owners, and we are now investigating those peatlands. And some words about visuality, reliability, and the role of art in this project. The investor can get good feelings for supporting art and local environmental work. It is very important part of the heliportry, because art helps deepening the experience that we all are together changing the world, changing the way of thinking human action in the globe, on this globe. We have to give back to the nature, not always take from. Investigating for art and restoring peatlands both get the result after a longer period, 10, 20, 30 years, maybe 1,400 years. We think opposite way than in market economy. With the help of the art, we also tell the results of the peatland to the people, then they can follow what is happening there in the peatland. In our market, money is not creating more money. We try to hide as much money as possible out of the ordinary devil's circle, ordinary stock market. And those words there in Finnish about the brand is exactness, reliability, masculinity, and kaurismäki. Thanks.
Thank you, Heikki. And we have a few minutes for questions. Here we have a question.
Thank you. I think it was very inspiring. I have a question. Do you collect the money, or do you have set a... Now we have a contract with the peat land owner. Do you have... set out how many stocks you can sell, or are you collecting the money first and then you try to find, and how do you make sure you're not collecting too much money and selling too many stocks so you can't actually find places to restore?
There are a lot of peatlands, and so I'm sure that there should be not too much money, but we have only one peatland now we are selling and telling what we are going to do, and so if there come more money, so we take another peatland and tell to the public what they can invest and pay for us. Did I ask your question?
Yes, I understand, because I see a similarity. There is a search engine on the internet instead of Google who's selling. Every time you search, they sell they will plant a tree, and now they're up to like 30 million trees. And I have like, will they ever make it to plant all these trees? I see the similarities. So to actually make what you're promising. So that was my connection.
Is there another question? We may have time for one more.
Yeah. Hello, Nina Nygren from University of Tampere. One comment and one question. I think 4,000 euros for a lifetime of compensations, this sounds a bit cheap, but the question is about the brand thing. Okay.
There is still time for questions in the end of the session. Okay, next we have Joanna Kuntonen, Anglo-American Policy for Biodiversity Offsetting. Please.
Thank you. So my name is Joanna Kuntonen van Triet, and I'm the Principal of Safety and Sustainable Development for Anglo-American in Finland. And I'm going to tell you about Anglo-American's approach to biodiversity, and I've got a short case study on the Sakatti project that we have in northern Finland. So our company has been on a bit of a journey, has been on a journey for the last 100 years. We turned 100 years last year. In terms of mining, I think in all honesty, mining hasn't changed too much in the way we do it the last 50 years. We pretty much do it the same way. Unfortunately for us, the world has changed in the meanwhile around us and where we mine and operate. And the communities have changed, and there's much less space. And we have come to the realization over the last 5 years or so, that we can't keep on mining the way that we've been mining in the past. Any one of our new projects is always going to be in someone's backyard, and because there's less space, generally any mining project that we have ends up having some overlap with biodiversity values. So in the last 2 years, our CEO, he's quite a visionary, actually, in terms of the way things need to be done in the future, and we need some step change, some radical change in the way that we do mining. And this has led us to having a new purpose for the company. And our new stated purpose in Anglo-American is that we're reimagining mining to improve people's lives. So in order to support this new vision that we have, or this purpose statement, we've also got a new sustainability strategy, which actually was published in March this year, so it's fairly fresh off the press. But it's been in development for over a year now, a year and a half maybe. It started off, it's very much strongly based on the SDGs and the targets that we have there. It's through discussing with our customers and our investors in terms of what they require us to do and what's expected in the future. It's based on our Future Smart Mining innovation, which is a process that we've been going through in the last 3 years and trying to look at new ways of doing mining, technical innovations mainly. And it looks at our material risks and opportunities that we have in the company. We started off with a very long list of goals and initiatives. There was over 50 of things that we wanted to do. But it's been a process of consolidation, prioritization, and we've come up with a short list of 9 priority issues that are centered around 3 strategic imperatives. So thriving communities, trusted corporate leader, and healthy environment. So the sustainability strategy is founded on critical foundations. So these are initiatives that we've had already for many, many years and have established. We are continuing progressing on these as well. And then we have the vehicles for actually implementing the strategy. There's 2 main vehicles. One is a collaborative regional development, which I'll talk about just now. And the other one is our 5-year sustainability plans, which I'll also talk about just now. And we didn't do this in isolation. Anglo-American is very much about partnership. We have a lot of partners across lots of NGOs and different fields. And as a matter of interest on the biodiversity side, we do work with WWF, Endangered Wildlife Trust, and especially Fauna and Flora International. We've had a global partnership with them for many, many years now. So all these folks gave feedback into our sustainability strategy, commented on it, and through that was also developed further. So I mentioned the collaborative regional development, and what we believe is a step change in the way we're approaching things. In the past, we've done a lot of work around our mining projects in terms of CSR and biodiversity initiatives, but they've generally been just around the mine, outside the mine fence, and haven't looked at a very sort of larger scope. And a couple of years ago, we started this process in the Limpopo province in South Africa, which is what this map is showing, in terms of looking at our operations more on a regional basis. So we have several platinum mines in the Limpopo area, and we started off with just looking at mega data, so data layers on top of each other, biodiversity data, demographic data, financial socioeconomic data, and layering those on top of each other. And through that, and in partnership with governments and NGOs, and other companies that also operate in that region, trying to analyze where are the key risk areas and where are the key opportunities in that region that we could actually get involved in to make a better difference. So through that process, we actually, in Limpopo, there's quite a few projects that were identified related to things like biodiversity, tourism, agriculture, and so on. And those were taken forward. And I think one of the cool things about this is that actually some of those projects that were initiated, Anglo's no longer the managing partner. They've been taken over by the other parties that are involved, and even the funding is mainly funded by other parties at the moment. So Anglo is just the catalyst in getting these things going. And now things are being looked at the regional scale. And I think through that we can have much more impact, a sustainable impact. And the plan is that we will do this sort of regional approach in every region where we operate over the next, well, plan is to start doing 2 per year over the next 5 years. The other vehicle for getting this done is these 5-year sustainability plans. So each one of our operations has to develop a 5-year plan in terms of how they're going to meet targets and objectives that are in line with the corporate targets and objectives to meet those visions that we have. So then if we just look at the group stretch goal under the strategy of healthy environment, the one that's of interest today is the one on biodiversity. And we've actually committed to delivering net positive impact across all of our operations. And we understand that's quite a big stretch, and we're not taking this lightly. But when we were trying to think of what is the vision statement that we can say on biodiversity, really at the end of the day, this was the only one that was a good enough vision and something that we could morally commit to. We couldn't really commit to anything less than that. And because it is quite a big stretch, we've tried to break it up into smaller pieces in terms of how we're going to start taking it forward. And these are the key steps in terms of meeting that vision in the long term. So obviously, we've redone a biodiversity standard, and we're doing site self-assessments against those at every single one of our sites this year and next year. We're developing biodiversity indicators and test projects to make sure that we know what we're actually measuring to meet those long-term targets, and that's being done mainly next year. We're doing net positive impact and biodiversity baseline assessments at every one of our operations over the next 2 or 3 years. We're also developing regional conservation partnerships. We actually have quite a few, especially in Southern Africa, but the idea is to have these partnerships in every one of the regions where we operate. And then each one of our operations already has biodiversity action plans in place, but we're reviewing those systematically to make sure that they're in line with the corporate targets and that by meeting and following those biodiversity action plans, we will actually meet those corporate targets. And very importantly, we're also looking at developing biodiversity talent in-house. Obviously, we need people who know what we're talking about and what the challenges are and how to fix those challenges also within our company. So that's a process that's also ongoing. So just to touch on, I'm not going to go into too much detail, but on the Sakatti project that Anglo American has in northern Finland, it's located in Sodankylä province. It's about 150 kilometers north of the Arctic Circle. It's a high-grade deposit, which means that the value of the ore and copper equivalent is about 8% over the life of mine of a minimum of 20 years, which is actually quite a significant deposit. It has all the strategic metals that Finland and the EU needs. There was some talk about the fossil fuels dilemma. Well, these are the metals that you need if we want to transform from an economy that's based on fossil fuels to an alternative energy economy in the long term. The project's in pre-feasibility stage, so we've done 2 preliminary feasibility studies, and this is the third one that's ongoing at the moment. Context-wise, it's in a municipality that actually is quite supportive of mining. There's one operational mine, and there's one mine that's on and off all the time. And a recent study that was done showed that 85% of those who answered the study in the municipality were supportive of mining. And that's quite an astounding number, actually, in terms of support of mining in a community. Some of the challenges that we do have, it's in a special reindeer herding area. And the biggest challenge of the project is that it's located in a protected area. So it's protected by both My Protection Act and Natura 2000. So biodiversity has obviously been a very key part of the project from the very beginning. Even during exploration stage, There's very strict rules and regulations in terms of how we can do exploration in the area. So we can only drill from old forestry areas that don't have such high biodiversity value or is not why the area has been designated for protection. We have buffer zones around all the drill sites and the routes. We use the closed circuit drilling method, so we collect all the cuttings and recirculate the water that's used in the drilling. So we only drill in winter when there's adequate snow cover, and we need to be out of the area by mid-March when the predators birds start their nesting period. We've also put in nest boxes for owls and new nesting sites for eagles, just in case there is some disturbance to them. And in general, the whole exploration process is planned so to disturb as little area as possible. So drilling many holes from the same location instead of disturbing several areas, for example. The mine itself, if it would be developed in the future, it's an underground mine. It would be located 350 to 1.2 kilometers below the surface. The idea is that it would be accessed through a portal that's located 5 kilometers away from the site, and the infrastructure area would be also located outside the protection area. So this is the protection area boundary. So the infrastructure area would be outside and accessed by an underground tunnel. The engineers are very much know that they have a mandate to look at minimization of impact in everything that they do. So trying to put as much of the activities as we can underground, looking at an all-electric mine and looking at paste backfill and dry stack tailings, so putting as much of the tailings back underground as possible. So avoidance and minimization is absolutely key in terms of developing this project. So the impacts on the protection area would be indirect, and there would be direct impacts on the area of the infrastructure. So we've done a lot of baseline studies in the area since 2009 on all sorts of from fauna and flora and so on. And we're looking at, and a lot of it in quite a lot of detail, and we're looking at different approaches for the compensation for those impacts that we potentially have. There's a different types of ecological compensation that will be required for peatlands and those for forests. We're following the guidance that was presented by Atte this morning, and we're using the best experts in the field in Finland, i.e. the authors of that paper, assisting us in trying to develop this compensation approach. The way forward for us is that at the moment the feasibility studies are ongoing and the impact assessments feeding into each other to minimize the impacts that we will have. Finally, we will have a footprint for the project. In the meanwhile, on the background, we have the concept study, a basic study done on whether biodiversity compensation would be possible in peatlands in northern Finland. And at the moment, we have in development a public discussion paper on the ecological compensation for the Sakatti mine. And that is what we will be discussing with our stakeholders later this fall. Once we know the footprint, we'll be developing an implementation plan for the no net loss based on the actual footprint. And if you're really interested in the technical details, we'll be presenting at the Arctic Biodiversity Congress in Rovaniemi in October. Then we'll have a more, once we're down the line a bit further, we'll have a more technical presentation on the contents of that compensation methodology. And finally, just in terms of our vision statement and purpose, a question, what would you see if a mining company owned this land? And this is what you would see. In fact, I can go back. This is land that's owned by Anglo-American, and hopefully in the future, all land that has mining on it will look like this.
Next, we are going to hear from Anders Forsgren, ecological compensations at the Aitik mine. Please.
Okay, thank you very much for the opportunity to give this presentation about how we work with ecological compensation at the Aitik mine. My background is in forestry, and I've been working for Boliden more than 20 years. I think this is a really interesting project. At first, a few words about Boliden. It's an integrated company with both mines and smelters. Operations are mainly based in the Nordic countries. And the mine I'm going to talk about is the northernmost mine, the Aitik mine, up in the northern Sweden. And this mine, it's a very large open pit mine. The pit is something like 3 kilometers long and 1 kilometer wide, 500 meters deep. So it's a big operation. Production rate is 45 million tons a year. And it's one of the most productive copper mines in the world, actually. And it has to be, because the copper grades are extremely low, only 0.2%. It started in 1968, and we have approximately 700 employees. And in 2010, I started a project for a new environmental permit. And the task was to get permit to raise production and to raise the dams of the tailings ponds. And this is an aerial photo of the tailings pond before the new permit. As you might see, we have dams on three sides, but on the southern side we have natural ground, which means that when we raise the dams with up to 30 meters, we have to use more land on this side. And as usual in the permitting process, we started early off with different types of inventories, natural values and protected species. And what we found was that this in red marked affected area had a lot of high and very high natural values marked in yellow and orange in the map there. And it wasn't surprising, since we have a large area south of the operations that is already protected as an ecopark. This affected area, it was old natural boreal forests, and the area with high natural values was 167 hectares. It was, to a very large content unaffected by forestry, only influenced by natural processes. We found plenty of dead wood with different qualities in different stages, and it had a very high variation in all different ways, and of course a large number of listed species. And knowing that, we started with the ambition that we have to work very thoroughly through the mitigation hierarchy, which we have done. The ambition was also to compensate for the remaining impacts, both for habitat loss and listed species. And the ambition was to compensate in what we said in a reasonable way, not to measure losses in details. And we also wanted to have a strong focus on follow-up and research. early in the project, we started an evaluation of compensation areas. It was done by the consultant Enersjær Natur, and we wanted them to identify areas suitable for compensation and also to propose possible measures to compensate the loss of habitats and species. And what did we look for then? We wanted the compensation areas to have old and semi-old forests, to be close to Aitik, and never clear-cut, but still affected in some way, lacking some structures that we would be able to create or to add. And if possible, close to other protected areas, and preferably on land owned by Sveaskog, Swedish state-owned forest company, and not to be considered for protection. The consultant did initial studies of available information, like aerial photos, on a big area, and also field studies in four different areas. They appointed one area named Sarkanene, which fulfilled more or less all the criteria that we wanted to. It's old forests, has some natural values, but still impacted, lack of dead wood, close to Aitik, and so on. Proposed measures. They were, of course, long-term protection. Since we had a lack of deadwood, we wanted to add deadwood from affected areas, create deadwood at site, free felling of old trees, encourage deciduous trees, actions to improve bird life, and burn some areas, and also improve situation for outdoor activities in the area. And this map shows what we ended up with. Red area is the affected area south of the operations, and the green ones ended up in two different areas with a total area of 837 hectares, of which 527 hectares were forest land, and the rest is wetlands. And what have we done so far in the areas? We completed a management plan, which is up to 10 years, and we did this in cooperation with Enersjær Natur and the landowner Sveaskog. We have also started a research project together with the Swedish University of Agriculture Sciences. We've done comprehensive baseline studies, inventories of affected area, and very much in detail at logs before transport. And up to date, we have transported 640 numbered logs in eight different types of dead and dying wood to create test plots in the compensation areas as a platform for future research projects. And we have a lot of ongoing activities for transport, creation of dead wood. And in all this, we also work together with the local community, reindeer herders and NGOs in the area. These are some pictures, how it looked like. In October, we brought out these logs. We did it on frozen ground with small vehicles. As you can see, it's numbered logs where we knew all species on each log. This is a picture of one of the test plots. And you can see we added a lot of wood on some of the test plots. Long-term protection. In this case, we have 50-year agreements between Boliden, county administration, and the landowners, where we agree that no activities other than to complete the compensation plan will be carried out in the areas. And we have also given the county administration the right to, without further compensation, to protect these areas as nature reserves. And we also wanted to ensure quality and function of the measures taken, and therefore we do that in many different ways. In Boliden, we take actions to ensure that the management plan is implemented. We do a lot of basic quality and function evaluations, and this will go on for at least 10-year period. And we also do annual reporting on this to the county administration. And I'm also very proud to present this unique large-scale research project. I won't go into any details in that. Tomorrow, Joakim Hjaltén will do a presentation about that. Boliden is also financing a PhD student in the scope of this area. And we hope that a lot of research reports will be published in the future. Working with this ecological compensation to Boliden, it's very reasonable and natural to do when we affect lands with high natural values. Thank you. This was a very short version, and if you want to have more information, please come back to me. Thank you.
Thank you. We may have time for maybe one quick question.
I'm wondering the time scale, only 50 years, and we are talking about forest ecosystem. It's a short time, so why it's not permanent forever?
I think Torbjörn mentioned it in the morning session. In Sweden, we have a regulation. We can't make deals longer than 50 years. And that's why we added on the option for the county administration to make a nature reserve of these areas. And I'm at least convinced that we will be able to create that type of values, that this will be a nature reserve in 50 years.
There was another question back there.
Hi, Brent Matthews from Dasos Capital. I'm just wondering, it seems that most of your partners are public sector partners, universities and state forests, so forth. Do you see any role for private sector in these sorts of activities?
Thank you. Next, we will have Kaisa Mustajärvi, ecological compensations from the perspective of an environmental consultant. Please.
Hello and good evening to everybody, and thanks to Janne for inviting me to speak here today. And I also want to thank my colleagues over there with their cameras, Heikki and Jussi, for commenting and contributing to my presentation. Raise your hands there. Yeah. And I also want to thank my international colleagues, especially Peter Burster from UK and Peter Booth from US, to give their insights within the kind of a global perspective to the ecological compensations in perspectives from a consultant. And first, I'd like to kind of give a short insight what Ramble is. I don't know whether we are that well known within terms of the biodiversity consultancy or ecological consultancy, but we are kind of a foundation-owned company originating from Denmark. We are, as I said, we are a foundation-based, which is very nice because as a child, my heroes were MacGyver and Knight Rider, and you know they work for foundation, so I kind of feel great for working for foundation, saving the world and such, you know. But it also kind of gives us the possibility to do a little bit more of research and development in terms of the work we do. So the foundation, for example, funds PhD for our workers that we can do a little bit more cooperation with in terms of the academia, for example. But our services across the markets are, for example, buildings, transport, planning, water, environment and health, energy, and management consulting. And I've been taught to say that if somebody asks whether Rabble can do this, I have to say that, oh, yes, and then find out who does it. But, well, yeah, we are quite wide kind of a range in terms of the consultancy and planning. But why I also want to show you these kind of our different services is that these different services are sort of our in-house stakeholders when it comes to ecological consultancy. And so kind of involving them within the discussion within when it comes to biodiversity work, ecology, ecological compensation is very important, and we need your kind of a help and input within kind of this kind of a stakeholder involvement also. Our geographical footprint is currently quite wide. A few years ago, we acquired a large international consultancy firm called the Environ, which is US-based, and now our environmental consultancy, kind of the masses for environmental consultancy are more located in the US. But it also kind of gives us the possibility to kind of share ideas and share knowledge and also benchmark from other countries. And we are sort of locally present, but globally can acquire information from several sources in several countries. Just to say that my job is there in the Nordics. I work for the Ecological Services Service Line. I'm the regional leader for that, and my job is to create or develop our service within the ecological services and the biodiversity work. We've been hearing a lot about the biodiversity, the compensation, the offsets, about the theory already, but my colleague Peter wanted me to include this slide so that we wouldn't forget that the compensations are there after the avoidance, minimizing, and rehabilitation. And then after those comes those residuals, residual impact that we are going to focus on with the compensations and offsets. But what kind of work we do in Ramble within terms of the compensation currently? I mean, I have to say that within a few years' time, the work has increased, and we can see that this kind of work really is happening now already. And what we do is we advise biodiversity offset plans for international lenders. It's the IFC6 kind of that currently keeps us busy within terms of the compensation work. We also, especially in the US, we have a long history of calculating inflicted damage for compensations. We calculate offsets or quantify offsets, for example, damage
incidents or damage risk assessment. But currently we are also working a couple of projects that we are involved with within sort of eco-asset evaluation, where we evaluate the client's assets for compensatory purposes. And we have a new project within terms of the developing criteria for biodiversity compensations also, both here in Finland and in the UK. And our major drivers within terms of the compensation work are, of course, the as I already mentioned, the IFC 6 performance standards, Natura 2000, of course, here in Europe, and also the ELD and ELD and US, we have the legislation in relation to environmental damage that we have a long history of doing that. But also the corporate sustainability report and corporate responsibility reporting has kind of arisen now in the field of our ecological consultancy, that there's a lot of, but there is work there to do too. And a lot of interest in terms of that too. And they need to define their effects on biodiversity and quantify them. But also branding and social license are also kind of drivers that are currently pushing this kind of work now. And what I feel and what I've been kind of interviewing my international colleagues with is that there's a lot of interest in the air. Well, there is interest in the air, but a lot of questions about the applicability and corporate benefits. And some forerunners are already active and others are waiting how it kind of plays off. But then a little bit about the global perspective that I mentioned in the beginning. I'm going to tell you about a little bit what kind of work we do within terms of the IFC 6 standards and also about the damage quantification or damage impact assessment that we do. But the principles that we are using mostly with our kind of international work is the BBOP. It kind of sets limits to offsetting and feasibility. The principles that we use that kind of are very present there is the additionality, equivalency, like for like or better, and that the permanence of the offsets, that project lifetime and on the ground action, and not really not focusing on the research but the on ground action, and the kind of practice, what kind of insights or what kind of experiences we'd had is that within terms of the international finance project, that the compensations can be very expensive, and it's important that we involve the third parties, government, local communities, as we've heard today in several occasions, but that large uncertainties within the demonstrating requirements can be met, and very large long-term commitment often for lifetime kind of projects. And another example that I have here is that my US colleagues wouldn't let me go on stage without mentioning this methodology that they have developed, so I'm going to kind of quickly introduce this to you, but this is called the habitat equivalency analysis, and my colleagues have been very much involved in developing this, but it's a way of putting these different ecosystem and biodiversity effects into common metrics and calculating the offsets in terms of either biodiversity or ecosystem services. And this is a project example from hydroelectric plant from Peru, where you can see that this is the metrics that we are using here is the habitat equivalency analysis, and we have here the kind of development of the service by year by hectare and the development by time, and we can also see that there's this time lag when the actual benefits are realized. It's taken into account in kind of measuring the offsets needed to compensate for the damage. And The other methodology that have been used in the damage assessment and eco asset evaluation, but also damage risk assessment as well as EIAs for the offsets, is the NEBA, that is net benefit analysis, and this is a kind of an application for NEBA. It's called the net ecosystem services analysis, and it uses the metrics from calculated before for the HEA, but this is for comparing different options, different options for example, remediation or offsetting, or it can be used also for soil remediation projects in terms of the comparing different alternatives. And then some experiences from the field. What I kind of interviewed my colleagues, and this is what came from them, is that what are the major obstacles is that we need for regulatory and or financial drivers, and it's hard to see the value since it's not acknowledged by the authorities. I'm talking about the value of compensation, and there's often a lot of prejudice for us to kind of push these through from the in-house stakeholders. And maybe just kind of a major take-home message from here is that there's a lot of possibilities in the gray area to say. We're talking about the not protected but valuable biodiversity habitats or services. But I think what we still need is to acknowledge and regulatory to put a kind of a value to this. And the kind of a picture that I have here is about trust, that we have to accomplish trust between different parties for this to kind of be operational. And also some needs, there's mentioned this trust, but also I would like to highlight here that we also need success stories. We often talk about a lot with the not-so-successful things and difficulties, but it would be nice to hear about the successes also. Thank you.
Okay, thank you guys very much. We have time for one or two questions. Yeah, go ahead. There is a microphone over there.
Yeah, I'm Eva Prima from the Finnish Environment Institute. Would you want to tell of a success story? One more.
Well, to be honest, I'd like to hear a success story from the audience and from the kind of presentations that we are having here during the conference.
Hello, I'm Minna Pekkonen from Finnish Environment Institute, and I would just briefly want to know that you were listing these challenges from international partners or colleagues, and which of them would hold for Finland or Nordic countries in your mind mostly? So is it the land for compensations, I think?
Okay, next we have William Velmela, and surprisingly he has the same title, Ecological Compensations from the Perspective of an Environmental Consultant. Please.
Thank you, Janne. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm William Velmela from Environmental Consulting in Pöyry, Finland. I will share you some of my views about ecological compensation. I will focus for Finland in this speech. I'm a biologist, an ornithologist, and as a consultant, my background is in field surveys of birds and bats and other animals, dragonflies, etc. Nowadays, I work a lot with other issues, but I still like to get my yearly stamp of a field ecologist, so I tend to try and get some field work as well. I will tell you a little bit about my company, Pöyry Finland, then about the controversy between biodiversity and business, then ecological compensation in the Finnish context, and finally show a few case examples. Pöyry is one of the major consultancy companies in Finland. We work mainly in the sectors of energy, industry, and infrastructure. We are over 5,000 people and represented in 40 countries. In the environmental business unit, we are about 120 people in Finland and Sweden. Our services, they cover the whole life cycle of the projects, from strategic planning to investing and operation phases, and finally exit phase. Some food for thought, how our future will look like in figures. Currently, the world population is at 7.5 6 billion people, 50% of us are living in urban areas, 1/12 of the population is over 65 years old. If you look a few tens years from now, we will be close to 10 million people, 2/3 of people are living in cities, and 1/6 are over 65 years. So basically, we are becoming more and more, we are consuming more and more, and still we are living on the same planet with the same resources as now. So something needs to be made about the way we are living. And as an environmental consultant, I've been trying to bring down the traditional conflict between biodiversity and business. They don't need to exclude each other necessarily. So we need to rethink the way we are using the resources of the planet. We need to use them wisely and in innovative ways. And of course, I'm trying to tell my clients that biodiversity often is a prerequisite to the operations they are doing in their business. So many businesses rely on the biodiversity, so we shouldn't ignore it as companies, as a society, and so forth. At the same time, there seems to be a change in the attitudes in the society. I think also nowadays we are seeing the value in nature as itself and not only resource or business value. So in Finland, ecological compensation is done currently at quite a small scale compared to, for example, continental Europe. It is mainly voluntary based. Some foreigners are doing development and testing projects, piloting projects, and then some companies, as we have seen today, have created management level policies in their parts as parts of their sustainability or responsibility programs, and also implemented actual actions in the field. Mandatory measures, compliance, in other words, they are currently rare in Finland. In the legislation, there are only a couple of cases where ecological compensation or compensation is mentioned. One of them is Natura 2000 network, where the EU legislation demands compensations if there are operations in the area that compromise the natural values. And also in the Water Act, there is it's mainly about compensating for fisheries losses and not so much for biodiversity. But then we have some specific project where authorities can demand compensation plan to be made. For example, if we are applying for an exemption permit. So basically, we are moving to the right direction. There are several examples already out there, voluntarily and mandatory examples. But if we really want to stop the loss of biodiversity, we should move maybe a bit faster. We have the will, we have the means, we have the hands, but I think the biggest thing that hinders us now is the lacking legislation and also funding for research and more piloting studies that actually are connected and so we can look into the results from these ones. And also there are, of course, a lot of examples from elsewhere in the world that we can utilize. There are many questions that still need to answer before we can go full speed with the ecological compensation in Finland. Currently, the consultant's role in Pöyry has been to participate in projects according to the following tasks that I've listed in this slide. We have participated in acting or designing and planning these strategic plans, and also in the ground level doing surveys, habitat and species surveys, restoration planning and execution, and also monitoring, which is an important part where we need to still figure out what practices would work in real life. And our role is also to help our customers to follow up on legislation and research and negotiate with authorities about reasonable offsetting. Then I'll show you a few examples where we are involved currently, so you get an idea about the consultant's role in all of this currently. We are preparing a compensation plan for sand martins, a swallow species. There is a hydroelectric power plant being planned in Lapland. It's an important area for breeding sand martins, and the water levels would drown these colonies in the river banks. So the authorities have asked a specific plan to be made so that we can mitigate the negative impacts on the sand martins. And it is still a work in progress, but possible measures would be clearance of trees in the river banks. They are growing and covering the banks that the swallows are used for nesting. Also, building of artificial nests is one possibility, maybe fencing the areas and controlling for nest predators, which are causing really a huge amount of nesting failures. The Finnish audience probably knows this project in other contexts, so this is not the only thing that needs to be covered in this particular project, but it's one part of it. Then another kind of example that I hope to be published really soon now by our client BioAcre. It's a tool for measuring biodiversity that we have developed recently. It is based basically on habitat quality and size of the area. It allows a company or other operator to look into a specific project area, evaluate the current state of biodiversity in that area. It takes into consideration several factors apart from the habitat quality as well. And it's useful for example, comparing implementation alternatives of a given project. And maybe with reservation, it could be used for measuring compensation needs. Then a last example, actually, this is quite a straightforward compensation plan for two protected plant species in Lapland. Several populations of these plants were discovered at the mining site, and since the company is applying for an exemption permit, the authorities demanded some compensation plans to be designed and implemented. And they include translocation of plants, additional field surveys in terms of discovering new areas of populations of these plants, and also establishing new protection areas for these plants. Okay, thank you.
There may be time for one question, but maybe not for answer, but nevertheless. We will have more time after the next presentation, so there is 15 minutes for questions. So everybody who didn't get an answer, you will get an answer at that time, because I believe that everybody except Linda is here still answering some questions after the next music. And next, we have the last consultancy talk. Teresa Lindholm is going to talk about combating climate change, biodiversity, and nutrient loss through improved collaboration between science policy and business solutions. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited to be here to listen to all the speeches and discuss with you. And now I'm actually talking about three different types of challenges and our view on how to improve collaboration between science, policy, and business. So first, a brief introduction. We believe that we need all possible solutions for combating these challenges. So Gaia aids companies, we aid the public sector, and we aid civil society with finding their role and the actions they can take. For example, Gaia itself is a climate-positive company, so we compensate our CO2 emissions of our own activities by 200%. This includes all traveling, so my traveling here, our emissions for electricity use, from heating, and also from commuting to work. And our approaches are based on international best practices, such as, for example, the mitigation hierarchy. And we also have a long background with collaborating with the scientific community. And we think also that this responsible offsetting solution, which are aligned with this mitigation hierarchy, these should be an integral part of addressing the most pressing challenges. And we also see it as important to understand the drivers of change. So we see these old drivers, which are regulation and technology, which is quite widely available, and knowledge. But we see the emergence also of new drivers along with these old drivers. This is money, so directing investments, and then awareness, which is connected to consumer preference. So market studies show that consumers know which option is the most sustainable option. They know it just as much in Europe as they do in, for example, Africa. And also, finally, then digitalization, which makes information more widely available. So several previous presenters have presented this project, this problem, that there's a gap between policy and business. So policymakers don't understand and use scientific evidence, and there's a need for more interaction and interpretation. But different methods for engaging business and policy, they do exist. There are, for example, CSR, incentives, and business models which are promoting more sustainable practices. And UNEP has identified some key aspects of bridging this science-policy interface. So first of all, you need motivated, capable actors and audiences. This means that this should be opportunities for exchanging evidence and expertise. And there should be true possibilities to actually affect the decision outcomes. And there should also be, of course, relevant actors present. And then there should be productive exchange, which means that there should be more facilitated learning than just disseminating information. And also there finally needs to be appropriate data and expertise. So up-to-date data on the state of the environment and linking it to social objectives. And also we need to use more local and traditional knowledge. So as I'm sure most of you have seen this picture of the planetary boundaries, and it shows that there are some areas where we're moving into these high-risk zones. And currently there are three of these areas where there are compensatory measures trying to alleviate the pressures, and amongst other means then. And these are the climate change, phosphorus and nitrogen flows, and then ecological offsetting or compensations, which is biodiversity loss and ecosystem integrity. So we'll talk about all of three of these, and there's some differences between these types of compensation. So the ecological offsetting is very local in its nature, and here national legislation and guidelines, they are still developing, and we need to define what to compensate. And also cross-border compensation of biodiversity is just taking off. And then we have nutrient recycling. Here, nutrients, they move in the water body to some extent, so the compensation is regional or local. And here, we need to define better the transfer between land and water. And then finally, in climate offsetting, here we have the whole Earth atmosphere accepted as an entity. So compensatory measures are crossing regional and national border lines. So how to engage business then in ecological offsetting? Business models is one way of doing this. So as an example, Metsä Hallitus, which is already was mentioned in one of the speeches, is a state-owned enterprise responsible for the management of one-third of Finland's surface area. And they have a high-level knowledge of restoration. They are managing our protected areas and cultural heritage sites and have a lot of areas when they are working on land area. And they are operating on a profit target, which means that they need to produce added value from the own land that they own. So they are looking for innovative business models, and they are interested in these. And our role then would be to describe most potential business opportunities and the business models that they could use, and also facilitating partnership between companies. Then we have also worked with this team of nutrient compensation or nutrient recycling. So a challenge in Finland is that fish farming has been on a continuous decline, even though the demand for food fish is continuously rising. So we are importing more fish all the time. And there's strict nutrient reduction targets to reach water quality targets. And there's also the VESA judgment, which means that there can be no deterioration of the good surface water status and the good surface water chemical status. So even if fish farming has improved vastly, the technology they are using and the process that they are using, reducing the nutrient output to really a minimal from what it has been, and they have reduced it so much that in the fish feed, they can no more reduce phosphorus without causing animal welfare problems. But still, their environmental permits are continuously being cut, so their production volumes are being cut. So there is then this need for new operational models, which can then take this sustainable growth and do it in harmony with the environmental targets. And here proposed then that the fish feed could actually include fish. So for a background, the fish is fed with fish feed, which contains imported fish meal and fish oil and soy. So we are importing nutrients to the Baltic Sea in the fish feed. And you could replace in the fish feed the fish meal and oil from locally caught fish and locally produced proteins that are replacements to soy. And in this way, you could improve the nutrient recycling and reduce the import of nutrients. So here we had then worked with trying to find incentives that would make the fish farmers want to actually invest, because the current situation is that they don't want to make any big investment because their environmental permits and production volumes will most likely go down. So it's not them moving forward, and we have the big question that should we not allow nutrient output from fish farming producing food and allow it then in other industries, and should we continue importing food for fish food? And then this climate challenge, where we think that the mobilization of private finance and know-how is a key. The good news is that there is a considerable number of stakeholders offsetting part of their mission. And for example, Osuuspankki, they have begun developing a roadmap towards becoming carbon neutral. This is a big bank in Finland. And they have begun this by developing a code of conduct, which is binding and obliges the movement towards carbon neutrality. And there's also an example of a project led by Gaia in Ethiopia, This project was awarded internationally as the best climate practice by the International Center for Climate Governance. And this is three Ethiopian microfinancing institutions which have established a concept to bring sustainable energy solutions to over 200,000 low-income households and micro and small and medium-sized enterprises. And this new business model, it finances several years of, for example, solar panel purchases. So summarizing here, Gaia's role can be to review the credibility and overall sustainability of the impacts achieved through investments, and we can also help understand and communicate this science base, so to say, of the sustainability targets and how they can be integrated into the whole value chain and technology and business model choices. So to conclude, there is a real need for concrete action, and there is a need to strengthen the science policy and business interface. And we believe that the responsible offsetting solutions which are aligned with this mitigation here, they should be an integral part, and especially because the challenges are so big, and addressing them at this required scale and speed requires all efforts. And the ecological offsetting, here the offsetting target should be specified, and if there is no progress on a voluntary basis, then a regulation is needed to clarify. And nutrient compensation, this has really very little attention, but it holds major potential. And in the climate sector, then we have this science-based mitigation targets, which are receiving increasing attention, and they are providing more responsible framework for offsetting. So these different methods for engaging business or policy, they exist, and these lessons learned and best practices, they should be spread further. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Now we do have some time for questions and an answer as well. I was thinking that, can you say something that how large business ecological compensations is going to be for the consultancy firms now when all of the businesses are thinking that, okay, we want to do voluntary offsetting?
This is a very hard question to answer. I have actually would say no idea, unfortunately. But of course, it's different if it's regulation or voluntary measures driving it.
Hello, Janne Seppänen from Pure Science. My question is actually to all three consultants. Your role is supremely important because often it is you who translate and bring the science from the scientists to either the decision makers in both the government or in big businesses. So it's actually you who make it possible for governments and businesses to become more sustainable and be responsible in governance. So my question is that have you thought about engaging the scientific community also by having your reports peer-reviewed by the community, because it would increase the credibility of your work, it would increase the responsibility of the work, and frankly, it would also be a business advantage for you, because then your competitors would not have that if you start to do that.
And all three of you can think about an answer for a minute, and then you are on the stage.
Thank you.
Okay, if I can ask all of the speakers of this session to stand up in front here, and I've give you a microphone that is on. If one of the consultants would want to start with answering Janne Seppänen's question.
Yes, I can answer this by we actually have released peer-reviewed papers. There have been mainly then on methodology, so more methodological aspects, and we do see them as an asset, which we can then tell people about. Yes.
Yes, and I also find the peer-reviewed kind of approach very valuable, but even though it is us whose report is being kind of reviewed, it's the customer's choice whether to pay for it. So I would very much like to kind of that kind of approach to be more common, but we still have some work to do with in terms of kind of launching it as the kind of protocol to be used. So I'm looking forward with the cooperation in terms of that.
Can I ask you back, would you be ready to act as peer reviewers? And if you want compensation for it, wouldn't you become consultants at that point?
So with the risk of advertising here, I try to avoid it. Obviously, you can look for other avenues too, but we already provide this service, and we have been working together with a Swedish company, and actually one of the panelists here also, in providing peer review for these reports. So yes, certainly we will do it. And the thing is that it's very important then for us to be seen as an impartial and independent party in that. And we do have a methodology designed to really make it so that the scientists who provide the peer review can actually do it independently. So we wouldn't be a consultant. We would be a sort of a consultant to a consultant, but from the point of view of your customers, you would be able to say that it's actually the scientific community that does that, and you wouldn't be able to manipulate the results or anything like that.
Okay, thanks. On a more serious point, many of the projects we've done so far are actually open to public. They relate to EIA procedures and so on. But from the methodology point of view, then definitely I think, yes, this way of peer reviewing is to go forward, I think.
I think it's an interesting question, and it would also be interesting for us as operators to get a second opinion on reports by consultants. So it's why not?
Okay. Then I think that there was Nina Nygren who asked a question early on, if she still remembers the question for, I don't remember for whom it was, but please, Nina.
Yes, thank you. It was for the Healy Percy compensation. Yes, about the was one of the last slides where you were presenting the brand and the values, and so masculinity was one of them, and that was why and how dare you.
It was not a biological term. Forgive me my English, because it should be another person here, but I try to say it in English, and if I can't, I say it in Finnish. We think about a lot, many times we think, who is the typical person we are going to influence, and we have read that in Finland and also maybe in the whole world, the typical person is woman who give money for the nature conservation, And the typical person who is not doing anything is a typical middle-aged man, engineer. And we try to find language which touch this kind of persons. They have money, and we like to give them opportunity to sponsor good things, art and nature conservation.
That's very nice aim, but maybe you might lose the women if you use that word out loud.
Yeah, that last slide, it was not made for you. It is inside making the brand.
Okay, next, Eva Primer. Just wait for the mic.
Yes, thank you. My question is a little bit of a reflection of the whole day with where the minister started the day. And I listened to all your talks, and somehow it sounds that there's a lot of readiness on the ground. All of you represent people who can do something about this. You can take compensations and offsets to action. And I started thinking that could we just regulate on it quite harshly? Could we take the risk of just establishing the regulation and then putting the innovation duty onto you and us knowledge producers? Because there is a little bit of a... So I'd like to hear your view on this, because it sounds a bit like everyone's presentation ends on, we are ready, what could you others do about this?
Anybody?
Well, we as a company are committed to it, so we don't need the regulation, but maybe someone else wants to answer.
I was thinking I'd like to move with this in terms of the scientific community. So are you ready to like make the recommendations that the government and authorities could sort of implement into this whole system?
And I would also like to add that we are doing, although I know the regulations are not ready and we're just hunting for pilots, that's what we do, and we are pushing it forward and we just want a little bit backup. That's what are we asking for, not really kind of a someone to drag us. We are going there already, but we just need to push that.
I would like to say that actually in the final slide I did mention that if nothing happens without regulation, we do think, because, for example, this nutrient compensation theme that I was presenting, unfortunately, we tried every type of voluntary and other models, and the final result is that nothing really moves without the regulation. So we have some experiences there, and it seems like similar situation with the other types as well.
I'm not convinced, at least, that it's the right way to rush into things. I might think it's better to think it over and do it right.
And I also think that self-regulation does have a role. So, for example, in the Finnish Responsible Mining Council that's developed best practice standards for Finland in terms of mining, there's a biodiversity standard, and in there, if you want to achieve a level A, then you're committed to no net loss. And if you want to achieve more than that, it's net positive impact. So I think from an industry perspective, also self-regulation is important.
Okay, I think that there, at back there, Dasos Capital had a question.
Sorry, I was really eager also to give a thought here on Ava's question, but then I have also a question for you. But my thought was that maybe it's important to make a distinction in the type of regulation that is being made. And I think here the appropriate incentives to kind of help maybe some reluctant companies get over that first step would be very useful, whereas a very heavy regulation that is just aimed at a specific outcome, as we saw in the earlier presentations, is maybe not always leading to the best results. So I think maybe it's good to think also how we can regulate in a way that helps this sort of self-regulatory actions to become really a trend, not just a small blimp, but really a trend in the private sector. And on that note, I would also then like to ask to both Johanna and Anders, what role do you see, because I think your presentations kind of highlighted that there is a lot of role for these public sector entities and also internal actions, but what role do you see for private enterprises who want to kind of enter these sorts of compensation and offsetting markets and provide services in that area, not just consultancies, but other sorts of business models?
Well, I mean, I guess there is a role if to make it easier to do these voluntary compensations, if there is some sort of system that's in place. Obviously, it makes it easier for companies, especially companies that maybe haven't got the internal resources and don't really understand the processes so much and that they can do it themselves. So, yeah, I think it would facilitate things. But then it would have to be a good system, because there's also very bad systems in terms of compensation banks out there. So it would have to be robust and something that the company could feel comfortable with, I think.
Yes, I agree. You have to find the forms to do it. So please feel free to come back if you want to invest.
Okay, I think there was, is it Åsa Granberg?
Yes, I it was a comment on you already said it so good that the message to the scientific world, I think, is to that things are already happening, and of course it's very important to not rush into things and to think the more strategic part over, but when it comes to metals and so on for restoration, when connected to offsetting, things are already happening, and we need the information and we need the backup from researchers who look into this. But when we don't have it, we do things anyway. So.
Okay, that was more of a comment than a question. The next over there. Yes.
Hi, Florence Damiens from RMIT University. Thank you very much for your presentations. Several of you mentioned in your presentation that you're developing some indicators, and I just wanted to know if it would be possible for you to extend a bit on that. Do you develop them internally? Do you partnership with some other actors? Are there any conversations going on between your companies? Basically, how does it work and how do you make this happen? Thank you.
The project I was talking about is in a very early stage, so I wouldn't open it up too much, but it's supposed to be with very kind of close cooperation with the stakeholders and the companies and their representatives and also the academia and people that have been working with the issue earlier on. But unfortunately, I cannot open it up too much at this stage, but maybe next year then.
The person I was talking about in terms of reaching our biodiversity targets. Don't make notes,
but you say. Thank you, everybody, and please be welcome back here 5 o'clock after the coffee, because then we have a panel discussion and we will continue on the same topics as we were just doing. Thanks.